Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have a special report on growing threats against school board members and educators locally and nationwide, along with polar opposite responses from the U.S. Justice Department and a local congressional member. Flu season is here, and county health officials are urging everybody to get vaccinated in time for the holidays to prevent a surge in influenza cases. We'll have information on where you can get flu shots, even if you don't have insurance, on today's show. The CDC is warning that COVID-19 can have serious or even deadly complications for pregnant women and their children, a point driven home by the tragic death of a pregnant San Diego woman in October. On People Power, hear about a dramatic swift water rescue of a woman who fell into a storm channel during a storm in El Cajon by Heartland firefighters who had just received a donation of rescue gear 2 weeks earlier. Our newsmaker interview today is with Rick Hall. He's the president of the El Cajon Historical Society. He'll share some stories from East County's past and his own family heritage as a descendant of one of El Cajon's pioneering families and tell you how you can help keep local history alive. And finally, on the second half of our show today, we'll share some East County ghost stories in the spirit of Halloween. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Across the nation, school board members, teachers, and school staff members report a rise in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence. In response, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced plans to convene a meeting with federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement leaders to create strategies to address this disturbing trend, including creation of a task force. The Department of Justice encourages education officials to report threats to the FBI's tip line at 1-800-CALL-FBI or on the FBI website at fbi.gov/tips. Attorney Garland says, "Threats against public servants are not only illegal, they run counter to our nation's core values. Those who dedicate their time and energy to ensuring that our children receive a proper education in a safe environment deserve to be able to do their work without fear for their safety." Republicans have criticized Garland for setting up what they term a snitch line on parents and voiced concerns over the potential to stifle free speech. But in testimony to the House Judiciary Committee, Garland made clear that he has no intention of targeting free speech, which he said is totally protected by the First Amendment, adding, "We are only concerned about violence and threats of violence against school administrators, teachers, and staff." Congressman Daryl Issa sees things differently. In response to the Department of Justice's announcement, San Diego's Republican representative has introduced the Stand With Parents resolution. Congressman Issa was joined by 22 of his colleagues in introducing this resolution, which specifically outlines the importance of parental influence in and outside of the classroom. In a press release, Congressman Issa states, "Parental input at the community level that is presented in a lawful and appropriate manner should always be received and not discouraged." He adds, "In numerous public meetings and even at the highest levels of government, parents are being labeled as domestic terrorists, and the Biden administration wants to silence them." Attorney General Garland's memorandum does not include the words domestic terrorism, and in his testimony before the Judiciary Committee, Garland said he does not foresee any circumstances where parents voicing concerns about their children would be labeled as domestic terrorists. The National School Boards Association sent a letter to President Joe Biden in late September asking his administration to intervene against malice, violence, and threats against public school officials, which the National School Board Association's letter said, quote, could be the equivalent to a form of domestic terrorism and hate crimes. Some of those incidents stemmed from parents upset over masking and vaccine mandates in schools, including cases of school board members stalked at home and threatened with violence. The National School Board Association later issued an apology for using the term domestic terrorism in its letter regarding parents. Dr. Darshana Patel, president of the San Diego School Boards Association, told CBS 8 that locally, around 10 school districts have recently had school board meetings disrupted. Poway Unified School District, where Dr. Patel is also a board member, recently had to end a meeting after protesters barged in. Patel says time-sensitive actions were disrupted, adding, it's our students who suffer ultimately as a result. The Poway district has since notified parents that anyone who disrupts a public meeting may be asked to leave, and subject to a criminal penalty of a $500 fine if they refuse to do so. The California School Boards Association has sent a letter asking our state's governor and attorney general for help. The association's spokesman Troy Flint told CBS that beyond protesters refusing to wear masks amid a pandemic and disrupting proceedings, some school board members in our county have been threatened and stalked. Both Flint and Dr. Patel said intervention is needed now before things get worse. "We want them to recognize there's a serious issue and take action that could prevent a tragedy," said Flint, adding that the First Amendment allows the public to speak, but not when it endangers the lives of others. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. The County of San Diego is ramping up its flu vaccination efforts to lower the risk of San Diegans getting influenza this holiday season. County health officials are concerned that this year's flu season will be more severe than last, when many people were staying home due to the pandemic. It takes about 2 weeks after vaccination to develop protection against the flu virus. That's why it's best to get vaccinated before influenza starts to spread in the community. So far this season, 229 flu cases have been confirmed locally, compared to just 10 last season. This year is actually up sharply over the prior 5 years, which averaged 163 cases by this time each year. So far this year, no one has died of flu locally, fortunately, but it can be deadly. In 2019, 108 San Diegans died of the flu. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that everyone 6 months and older get a flu shot every year. It takes about 2 weeks for immunity to develop. The CDC also indicates that it's safe to get a flu and COVID-19 vaccination at the same time. The flu vaccine is especially important for people at higher risk of having serious complications from the virus. They include those with chronic medical conditions like asthma, diabetes, and lung disease, even if symptoms are under control. Also pregnant women, people age 65 and older, and those who live with or care for others who are at higher risk. The influenza vaccine is now available at doctors' offices and pharmacies and covered by medical insurance. People with no health care coverage can get vaccinated at one of the county's 6 public health centers or a local community clinic. To find the nearest location, you can call 211 San Diego. Now, here in East County, volunteers in medicine will be offering free flu vaccines as well as free COVID-19 vaccines on Monday, November 8th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at 1457 East Madison Avenue in El Cajon. Again, that address is 1457 East Madison Avenue in El Cajon, Monday, November 8th from 3 to 6 p.m. So you can get both vaccines to protect yourself and your family in time for the holiday season. Now, in addition to getting vaccinated, health officials recommend doing the following to avoid getting sick. Wash hands thoroughly and often. Use hand sanitizers. Stay away from sick people. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean commonly touched surfaces. And if you are sick, stay home and avoid contact with others. Wearing masks in crowded public places can also help prevent you from catching the flu as well as other illnesses.
A warning from the CDC. COVID-19 can cause serious pregnancy complications. Not only do expectant mothers suffer more serious complications, but so can their unborn children. We have more to report at the local level, but first, our national COVID-19 report. Pregnant women with COVID have a 70% higher risk of death than people who are not pregnant, according to the CDC. If you're pregnant and unvaccinated, both you and your unborn child are at higher risk of contracting severe COVID-19. Based on research to date, COVID-19 can increase the risk of bleeding disorders, high blood pressure, maternal death, and stillbirth, warns the CDC. COVID-19 vaccines are safe for you and your baby, the CDC reports. As an added benefit to the vaccine, recent studies show that vaccinated pregnant mothers pass antibodies to their developing babies in the womb, so babies are born with some protection against COVID-19. The CDC followed more than 35,000 people who were vaccinated during or just before pregnancy. Researchers found no obvious safety concerns for pregnant women who received the vaccine. The study results are also based on what is known about how the vaccines work. They do not contain live virus, according to the CDC, so they cannot give someone COVID-19 disease. Based on research to date, serious side effects from vaccines are extremely rare. Pregnant women who receive the COVID-19 vaccine may experience side effects such as body aches, chills, and tiredness, which are normal for everyone. According to the CDC, the three vaccines are very protective. They advise that pregnant women and nursing mothers can receive any of the three COVID-19 vaccines which are currently available in the U.S. At the local level, in San Diego, an unvaccinated woman is the first pregnant woman to die from COVID-19, the County Health and Human Services Agency announced October 8th. As we reported earlier, the CDC reports that pregnant women with COVID-19 have a 70% higher risk of death than people who are not pregnant. The San Diego woman died in early October after being hospitalized, as did her unborn child. Her age and other details about her death and pregnancy are not being reported to protect her and her family's privacy. Seema Shah, MD, Medical Director of HHSA's Epidemiology and Immunization Services Branch, says, "This is a very unfortunate death. Our sincere condolences go out to the family and friends of the deceased. Contracting COVID-19 during pregnancy puts you and your baby at greater risk of having serious complications and death. Dr. Shah urges anyone who is pregnant and unvaccinated to get immunized to protect not only themselves, but to also protect their babies." On October 6th, the County Health and Human Services Agency issued a health alert to the local medical community of an increase in cases and hospitalization of unvaccinated pregnant women. They encourage the medical community to urge their patients to get vaccinated. From June 1 through September 30, 2021, there have been 253 laboratory-confirmed cases among pregnant women, including 203 among those not fully vaccinated. This is compared to 50 who were fully vaccinated. Of the 253, a total of 31 required hospitalization. 30 of those hospitalized were not fully vaccinated. Not fully vaccinated is defined as being unvaccinated or having received a single dose of Moderna or Pfizer COVID-19 vaccines. Fully vaccinated is defined as being 14 days after the second dose of Pfizer or Moderna COVID-19 vaccines or a single dose of Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In late September, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a health advisory strongly recommending that people get vaccinated against COVID-19 either before, during, or after pregnancy, including those who are breastfeeding, because the benefits of vaccination outweigh known and potential risks. According to the CDC, pregnant women who contract and develop symptoms from COVID-19 have a twofold risk of admission into intensive care and a 70% risk of death. Dr. Joanna Adamczak, a maternal-fetal specialist and chief medical officer of Sharp Mary Birch Hospital for Women and Newborns, says, "This is heartbreaking and tragic news that a pregnant mother and her unborn baby have died from this terrible disease." She adds, "We, as healthcare providers, urgently encourage anyone who is pregnant or plans to get pregnant to get the vaccine. It provides important protection for both mom and baby." There are over 400 locations where San Diegans can get vaccinated against COVID-19. They include doctor's offices and retail pharmacies, Rite Aid, Walgreens, CVS, etc., community clinics, and county public health centers. Nearly 80% of eligible San Diegans are now fully vaccinated, and nearly 90% have had at least one vaccine dose. There is plenty of COVID-19 vaccine available in the region for San Diegans who are eligible and due for a booster shot, and for San Diegans who have not yet been vaccinated. You can find a complete list of locations at coronavirus-sd.com.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Elijah McKee with East County Magazine's People Power Report. Firefighters with Heartland Fire and Rescue saved a woman who fell into a storm drain in El Cajon on October 4th when a thunderstorm brought heavy rainfall. Witnesses called 911 to report that the woman was trapped in fast-moving waters in the Forester Creek flood channel. Units from Heartland Fire and Rescue, Santee Fire Department, and Viejas Fire Department responded to the call. By this time, heavy rains had substantially increased the amount and speed of water flowing through the flood channel, according to a press release and video posted by the City of El Cajon on its social media. The closest unit to the initial reported location was Heartland Fire and Rescue's Squad 6, a fast response pickup truck staffed with two firefighter paramedics. Additional units were responding from further than normal due to a surge in storm-related emergency calls. When Squad 6 firefighter paramedics Louis Kinoshita and Mike McKee were unable to locate the victim at the initial dispatch location, they continued downstream, where residents flagged them down and indicated that someone was in the water. Fortunately, just 2 weeks earlier, Heartland Fire and Rescue received swift water rescue equipment donated by the Firehouse Sub Public Safety Foundation. The firefighters grabbed their new swift water rescue equipment and scaled an 8-foot-high chain-link fence separating the street from the channel. The team wrapped one end of a rescue rope around a fence post and threw the rope with a loop tied in it around the victim, who was clinging to the concrete wall of the channel. Using the newly acquired equipment, they were able to pull her up to the edge of the channel, assess for injuries, and wrap her in a blanket. The victim was then loaded into an ambulance and transported to Sharp Memorial Hospital. She told rescuers that she'd been swept down the channel approximately half a mile. The grant provided Swiftwater personal protective equipment to every emergency apparatus in the fire department. The equipment included personal flotation devices, helmets, flashlights, rope bags, and rescue knives, arriving just in time to enable crew members to safely conduct the rescue that saved a woman's life.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And my very special guest today is Rick Hall, who is the president of the El Cajon Historical Society. And we're delighted to have him with us here on the show to share some interesting information about El Cajon's colorful history. Rick, I hear that you are a descendant yourself of one of the prominent pioneering families locally. Can you share a little bit of that history?
Sure. Our family arrived in the valley in 1886, and when there was about 12 families in the valley. So wow. Seen some changes since then, obviously.
I could imagine. What did your family do here locally?
They basically started off as an agriculture, which El Cajon was big in at that time. Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather had a 40-acre farm over near where Granite Hills High School is now. And I think he actually expanded that a little bit later on, but I think he did some fruit trees, et cetera. And grapes were really big in the valley at that time. So everybody kind of grew some grapes for the raisins, of course, because
the capital of California here.
Right, exactly. At one point in 1893, I think it was, our raisins were sent to the Chicago World's Fair, and they won first place for their quality over the whole nation. So we had some very top quality agriculture in the valley.
Yeah, it's interesting that the wine region, the grape growing, is coming back, but for a different reason these days in some parts of East County. So yes. Tell us a little bit about the El Cajon Historical Society. When was it founded?
It was founded in 1973. I've been volunteering with the Historical Society for a little over 35 years. Mm-hmm. This will be my fifth time next year as president, and we have a very, very good board. We're all very concerned about what's coming up as far as our next year, the deficit that we're facing. This will be the first time in our 48 years that we've had a deficit budget.
Now, is that because of COVID-19 and the fact that nonprofits obviously weren't able to hold events, a lot of the donors... I know all nonprofits were facing issues with that.
That is correct. I know our situation isn't unique, and I certainly understand that there are very worthy causes that need donated funds right now. It's just for us that we've always been able to take care of ourselves, and this is a little bit of a unique situation.
Well, it's important to keep history alive in East County. These stories, you know, if they're not recorded, not written down, people forget the past. And of course, we could all learn from the past for the future. Where can people donate, or for that matter, volunteer and get involved if they want to help the El Cajon Historical Society?
Well, our P.O. Box is P.O. Box 1973, El Cajon 92021. So that is one place that they could send donations. We are a 501c3 corporation, so the funds that are donated should be deductible. Yeah.
Is there a website?
Yes, there is. You could go to elcajonhistory.org. That would be there. And I believe in there is the email address. So there's a way to contact us that way. The website is now back up and running. It was down for a while during COVID, but we're back up and going now.
Well, I'm glad to hear it's back up. You certainly have a lot of really interesting information up there. Can you share a little bit about the museum that the Historical Society operates and what people can see, where it is and what it's called and where people can find it?
Sure. It's at 280 North Magnolia on the corner of Park and Magnolia. We are currently in a kind of recovery right now, but we are open the third Saturday of each month from 11 to 2. The museum actually...
And it's called the Knox House Museum, K-N-O-X.
Correct. It started off actually as a hotel. Mr. Amaziah Knox came to El Cajon Valley in 1869. And soon after he got here, I think most people would recognize that gold was discovered up in Julian in 1870. And what Mr. Knox was starting to notice is people were traveling, of course, from San Diego back and forth to get supplies, mm-hmm. and stopping really right near the corner of Main and Magnolia, what is now Main and Magnolia. It wasn't anything then, and just camping out there. So apparently he had the idea that a hotel might be a good thing. Soon after the hotel, a lady came from back east with her husband who had consumption, which is tuberculosis, I guess.
Yes.
And he unfortunately did not survive. And so one thing led to another. Mr. Knox and Ella Birdsey became married, and then the hotel became actually the Knox House. They stayed in the hotel business by putting a 24-room annex onto the side of the house.
Interesting. So
that's a brief history. It also became the first post office in El Cajon, too.
So. You mentioned gold mines. A lot of people don't know there actually was a gold mine in El Cajon at one time. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. There was some information about it being along the hill alongside of Chase, up above Chase along there, and there was supposedly another one that did pretty well over near Grossmont Summit.
Yeah, all these little fascinating bits of trivia. Now, the city has been a city officially for a little over 100 years. I believe they had their centennial in 2013, so a city was declared in 1913. Tell us a little bit of the colorful history of El Cajon's past, maybe a couple of good anecdotes to share that people can learn if they come to your site or visit the museum.
Well, one thing on our site is a tour of the museum. So if you're not comfortable and yet venturing out with the pandemic, we have a virtual tour of the museum on the website.
Oh, that's nice.
There are also some stories that some of the early pioneers have written that we've posted on there. So we do have that. Some of the things that I think that's happened through the years have been sort of interesting. I know that my great grandfather at one point, he actually got into the hardware and building materials business when he went up by where the trolley is nowadays to buy some lumber and ended up with the whole lumber yard. And then he moved it down at 230 East Main Street. And one of the things that he found there was a very, very good well. He built a large storage tank for it and ended up running pipes down Main Street to some of the other businesses. So that was kind of a early water district, I guess, so to speak, which it wasn't, but it became a place to supply water to some of the other businesses.
Very interesting. I remember when I was covering the centennial celebration, a fascinating fact that stuck with me was that when they became a city, one of their first official acts was to outlaw horse racing down Main Street and ban saloons.
I think that's certainly true.
So. Well, times have certainly changed a lot. And I think it's important to note, too, that history is ongoing. And is the Historical Society doing any kind of outreach to capture or record living history, you know, some of the things that are not ancient, but that are still occurring now?
We have done some of that in the past. One thing we're very interested in at this point is to see if we can reach out. And we have tried a little bit to reach out to the Chaldean community to get some of their history. How did they choose to come to El Cajon? How did some of the things they experienced in coming here? And so we are very interested in learning more about that, because certainly they're going to be a part of our history going forward. So.
Yes, and actually there are really immigrants from around the world coming to El Cajon now. The most recent are the Afghan refugees. I just interviewed one of them yesterday.
Yes.
And people from Syria who've come from the war there, some people from Africa who came here as immigrants or refugees, and I'm sure many other places, Mexico, certainly. So you're right. It is an interesting history that evolves. In the early days, it was all the pioneers from back east and some Spanish history. And of course, Native American history before that, that goes back some 10 or 12,000 years locally. But it's ongoing. And I think it's important for a historical society to continue to be around to record this history so that it won't be lost. So tell us a little bit more about fundraising efforts, and how much are you hoping to raise?
Well, we work on a very austere budget. Most people would probably be surprised that we are able to survive on what we're surviving on.
Yeah.
Right now, we are probably about $1,000 to $3,000 short of breaking even. And so we were hoping to raise something like that.
Yeah, so one big donor could do it, or a lot of little donations. Do you do sustaining donations? Can people buy memberships, or do you have events or any other ways that people can help out?
Yes, absolutely. Our memberships really never actually, and this is done intentionally, is we never bring in enough to meet our budget. We've always, as a board, made the decision to keep our memberships very low so more people could participate in the saving of the community or in the interest of the community. So we always have to have some sort of a special event or something to sort of make up the shortfall. Well, that wasn't possible last year because there was nobody having any special events. So.
Right. I know our nonprofit went a year and a half with none, and all of them that I spoke with have been struggling because of that. Do you have any on the horizon?
Well, one thing we're hoping to explore is crowdfunding. We don't know, being historical, we don't know too much about crowdfunding, but we're going to try to learn. Another thing we hope might happen is that some of our members might help underwrite some of our expenditures. So maybe somebody could pay for our telephone expenses or something to that effect.
Well, that's a great idea. People love to know how their donation is being spent to target it specifically. That is always a good idea, I think.
I'd just like to say, in regards to that, we as a board take the funds that are entrusted to us very seriously. And one of our driving principles is to be good stewards of those funds. So I don't think
very important.
I don't want anybody to feel that those would go to waste if they donated them. So
no, it's always nice to have those general fund donations that you can spend wisely and as you see fit. Have you ever thought about doing any events sort of like what Old Town does, where they bring history to life with reenactors or people reading scripts or contests to encourage people to send you their historical stories? You know, maybe public readings, dramatic readings, to recreate and build interest in El Cajon history.
That is very interesting. And I think right now, most everything's on the table. Mm-hmm. We did have a third grade essay contest for about 30 years that has had recently gone by the wayside. Those would be interesting to try to revitalize too. One of the things that was in conjunction with that was having third grade tours, school district tours, come to the Knox House That, of course, wasn't possible with the pandemic. So that's something we're looking at again to see if what the logistics of that might be, because the Knox House is rather small. And to bring in 35 students into a small area like that is something that we have to figure out how that's going to work.
Yeah, difficult. Maybe, you know, maybe do some outside presentations or something until we get through the COVID era completely.
Correct.
We all hope will end one of these days. Again, listeners, you can go to the El Cajon Historical Society website, which is elcajonhistory.org, to learn more or donate. Or I imagine, like all nonprofits, you probably also need volunteers. Can you tell us about those opportunities?
Sure. We can always definitely use volunteers. It would be mostly probably at this point for docenting, telling the history of El Cajon.
Yeah.
And we have a docent handbook that someone could read to brush up on that, and maybe kind of mirror. We only have two or three docents right now, but they could mirror some of the docents to kind of learn more as the tours are being given. So,
very good. What else would you like the audience to know out there about the El Cajon Historical Society that we haven't already discussed?
Well, I think that it's important for the community to realize there is an El Cajon Historical Society, for one.
Yeah.
We often get people come in into the Knox House and say, gee, I really didn't know you were here, or I've been trying to get in here for a long time. And so just really to let your viewers know that we're here, and we've been here for 48 years. We're thankful to still be here, because certainly we've watched many businesses that didn't survive the pandemic. So we're very thankful to still be in existence, and we are going to work very hard next year to remain that way.
And listeners, the El Cajon Society wants to hear from you. If you have any historical photos to share or stories to tell, ranging from the Native Americans to the early pioneers to some of the new immigrants from around the world who've come here, you can get in touch with them by emailing echs0997@att.net, or you can go to their website at elcajonhistory.org. We've been speaking today with Rick Hall, the president of the El Cajon Historical Society.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reaching Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thieves survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of 3 emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the 3 travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other 2 men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other 2 noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The 2 men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The 2 men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the 3 emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the 3rd arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired 2 other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had 3 ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around, but he ordered the other 2 ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost a million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's Navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Kaweah Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Kaweahs began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Kaweah did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with a fortune in pearls still out there in the desert? perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day, when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats, until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994, when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brook, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. "I sure froze in my tracks," she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.